Welcome back to Brothers in Song, everyone. How are you doing today, Joe? I understand we have a burgeoning songwriter in your family.
It's possible. He had a lot of guidance from his very talented parents, but I give him full credit for that one. He chose the key of A minor, which is a good place to start. I was glad that he did that. And we're talking about my son, Rory. He's seven. He takes piano and he studies the Suzuki method. So it's very much kind of an all-encompassing style of learning with your fingers and your ears all at the same time. And he had a little concert yesterday of something that he actually composed himself. So it was fun to hear him kind of develop those skills on his own. So thanks for mentioning it. How are you?
Yeah, I'm doing good. I was working on my own music today. I don't know if Rory's music was a little bit more complex. I noticed that there were like tempo changes and other stuff going on in there.
Got to keep you on your toes, man.
Yeah, there's competition. And I need the attention. So Rory's got to sit back for a couple of years. But in any case, we have a lot to get to today. I think it's going to be a fun episode. We have a special guest with us, and we're very happy he agreed to join us on the program. It's someone I've known for a long time, but haven't really talked to in quite a few years. A gentleman by the name of Greg Massey. Greg is a guitarist and composer. He's originally from our hometown of New Britain, Connecticut. He's known primarily for his involvement with the bands Maudlin of the Well and KO Dot. He spent 3 years writing and producing professional wrestling entrance music for the Indie Federation Capital Wrestling, which is now known as Catalyst Wrestling, as well as freelance for other indie wrestlers. His current projects include prog rock band Balaset, the doom metal band Concilium, and his solo ambient dungeon synth material, which is known by the name Dalliad. He's a podcaster as well, another great music podcast called The Color of Air, and he's back from a tour, which we will be sure to ask him about. So welcome to the program, Greg.
Thank you. I was super psyched for you to ask me to do this. I'm totally psyched. This is awesome.
Good. Well, we're glad you could make it. And we asked you on here so we could, pick your brain a little bit about guitars and guitar playing. A number of months ago, we did an episode about guitar heroes that we hope everyone will check out. And this time we wanted to focus on some artists that have created innovative and distinctive sounds on the acoustic guitar specifically. But first, since you're just like us, a musician and a music lover who also happens to have a regular job.
Yeah.
like most people who make music. I mean, there are very few people who get to, make a living at it. We're going to talk a little bit about like your experience with that.
Sure.
As I said, while we've known each other since middle school, we've been in and out of touch over the years. And, for me, from my end of the experience, all of a sudden, one day we found each other on Facebook.
Yep.
And you just had like this kick-ass metal band and you're building guitars inspired by G.I. Joe colorways. Yeah. you got a podcast. So I definitely missed like all the work that kind of like went into getting to that point. How did you get started with the guitar and everything?
Well, it's funny. I was kind of hoping you'd ask me this because not just because I love talking about myself, but I wanted to acknowledge to you here that you had a very important part in how this whole trajectory happened. I don't know, you may or may not be aware of this, but a lot of people, I feel, kind of either come into their own or start to come in their own with what they want to do in high school, you know. But for me, our middle school was really, my middle school experience was really what kind of prompted me to want to do creative stuff. And I think, so part of it is a couple different things. One was, I was exposed to a bunch of music I hadn't really, if you can remember all the hair metal and everything else mm-hmm. that was going on, 89, 90. And I remember hearing you and Dennis talking about those different bands, Dennis Chase, another great person from that era. And so it was between that and also Ryan. I don't know if I should be saying all their full names, but if they listen, but Ryan Cole was another one who introduced me to a lot of bands. And the other thing too is that there was a lot of artists for some strange reason, like graphic, like you were doing art, Brandon, Ryan. There was a bunch of people who were like doing really cool drawing and stuff like that. And I was like, I'd love to learn how to draw. And it became this kind of thing where it was like, I was wanting to learn how to draw maybe, but I was also wanting to learn. I wanted to learn to play bass guitar, to be honest with you. I wanted to learn to play bass guitar because of Bobby Dahl and Poison. And a lot of that stuff. So a lot of that came from that experience of just wanting to express, to do something artistic. And I hadn't really thought about that up until that point. And so it was during middle school that I got, my mom bought me like art supplies. And then also my sister had an electric guitar that she wasn't using. So it was kind of like, I was kind of in this weird place where I'm like, oh, I love artistic stuff. I want to do it. And my mom was like, well, we can pay for art lessons or we can pay for guitar lessons. You choose. And I ended up choosing guitar, but it could have easily gone the other way. but anyway, you had a very, very big part to do with that. And the other people we went to school with, I mean, just in terms of, cause I didn't know what I was into musically before then. And, I was scared of heavy metal at the time, being a good Catholic, good Catholic boy. But I learned and I got really into all that different stuff and then started me on the path to guitar. And then it was just guitar lessons and doing the thing everybody talks about, like staying home in high school and playing for hours upon hours. I didn't practice very well, I don't think, but I would play guitar for a while and try to learn my favorite Iron Maiden songs and Metallica songs. And it's funny you talk about, music, not making a living off music. And I'm just like, those rock stars we grew up watching lied to us. They're living this really cool lifestyle. And you're like, that's what I want to do. And that is not at all the trajectory of what where music brought me. So that's the basic answer in terms of getting into guitar.
Yeah, I never really knew that. And you're kind of conjuring up some memories for me, just details about people that I had kind of forgotten. And I don't know, there's something about Catholic school. I think it's like the rigidity of the rules mm-hmm. that, make kids want to go the other way. It just, it has the opposite of its intended effect on children, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, it can do that. I don't know what it was about that. I don't know what it was, but it's just, I just felt there was, like I definitely thought my middle school experience was a lot more, like high school was terrible. I hated high school. I mean, cool stuff happened in high school. I mean, I met friends who I've been in bands with and who I've known and, for years now, and you know, an important relationships and everything like that. But I felt like my middle school experience was like everybody, you know, I felt it was like everybody was kind of cool with each other. I mean, it was a small school anyway. You know, but part of me kind of wishes I went to New Britain High as opposed to Aquinas, because, you know, that was the big, you know, I don't know how I would have fared at New Britain High, but you know, I wonder about that sometimes, you know, being in a big high school as opposed to a small high school.
I don't know, for me, going from the small Catholic middle school to the public high school was a big, big culture shock.
I can imagine.
Joe, you were, I don't know. I'm going to go out on a limb and say that Joe was a more popular kid than perhaps Greg, me and Greg. I don't know. How was that for you?
Well, you know, those Madrigal costumes, like, you know, they're just magic in the social circles, you know,
the maroon and gold, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because I certainly felt, you know, I had plenty of influences. Dan, you certainly were one of them early on, but I feel like, especially as I went down the path of studying classical music and opera, is really through college and grad school where I really like refined my taste and got exposed to stuff and really could have my own opinions about stuff and not just sort of reiterate what other people have told me to think about certain pieces of art. But before we get into the tracks, I just want to circle back to something, Greg, because I was a, you know, classically trained opera singer for a while, and even during, you know, even when things were going good, you still had to have another thing on the side just to kind of make ends meet, like a lot of musicians do. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you've built your life with being able to do that. And it's not so much like the time management, because I feel like there's plenty of things that can help us get organized around that and like figuring out the time to do the things that we love. My question for you is really like, even when you carve out that time, like, how do you get in the right mindset to be creative and make things that, you know, maybe your brain has been doing something else all day. And now you're like, all right, I have this chunk of time. I want to work on my music. How do you kind of get there to do that?
That's a great question. And I really wish I had a really good answer. And I really wish somebody could teach me the right way, because I'm terrible at it. Because yeah, like, I mean, I worked, you know, a regular job or whatever, but it's like, you know, get up, walk the dog, go to work, cook dinner, you know, I'm married, so make sure you spend time with your wife walk the dog, bed. And, you know, and sometimes it's like, I'll have a free chunk of time. I'm like, oh, I really should work on this music. And I don't work on it. Where I find is a lot of times stuff that happens for me creatively is when I grab an acoustic guitar or an electric guitar and just kind of strum around while I'm watching TV or just, you know, on the couch, you know, stuff like some things will happen like that. Also, I listen a lot to stuff when I'm at work, cause I can put on headphones. And so I've got, I was telling Dan before the podcast, you know, I've got a lot of unfinished music, and I will listen to those tracks and try to do creative stuff in my head. Obviously, I can't, you know, sit there at work writing music. I mean, if I'm working from home, that's a little different.
Yeah. So if you feel inspired, you can just go over to a keyboard or a guitar and tinkle around for 15 minutes, and then
But it, you know, it's funny because I was having this discussion with a friend of mine, who I find to be a very inspirational person. This her name is Steph, and she was in Massachusetts. She was a doctor of music, so she would, you know, teach composition. She would teach all sorts of these other things, and she was also a tattoo artist, and, you know, and her work ethic is like amazing. And I remember asking her how she finds time, and she was just like, the biggest thing is to not wait for inspiration. That's the biggest pitfall I think that people do, is they say, well, I just want to wait for something to hit me and whatever. And she's like, and that's not the way it works. You know, you just have to like sit there and do it. And, you know, sometimes stuff will come out, sometimes stuff won't come out. And I find that to be true so many times. Like sometimes a lot of stuff that I write that I really like will come from, will not come from like a divine inspiration. It'll just come from me sitting around playing and mm-hmm. and just
putting, you know, in the work and figuring it out.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And you know, and with me, with like guitars, I mean, my one of the things I love doing is alternate tunings. And so like I'll just be like, oh, let me put my guitar in a strange tuning and see what happens. And and you know, sometimes nothing happens, and sometimes I come up with a really cool riff or a chordal idea or something like that. So yeah, just do it, I guess, is the bottom line.
Yeah, that's good. You advice.
Know? One of the best pieces of advice I ever received in that regard, it actually came from like somebody's Instagram post. And the guy talked about following the law of I may as well.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of getting overwhelmed by, oh, well, I can't start this thing because I want to spend all day doing it because I need a huge chunk of time to get it done and da 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 da. And, you know, just kind of like making all these excuses because you feel like you don't have the time. It's kind of like, just say to yourself, well, I may as well spend 15 minutes doing this. Let's see what happens in 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. And then maybe you only spend those 15 minutes, but maybe it sets you down a path. And then before you know it, you've spent a half an hour or an hour doing that thing. And at least you're progressing forward or learning something about what you're making. And, you know, I really try to follow that, especially when I feel stuck, if I'm you know, trying to make something, or even when I'm trying to, like, not to digress too much, but even when I'm trying to like do stuff around my house and I feel like, oh, I can't do this because I don't have this, that, or the other thing, it's like, well, you may as well spend 10 or 15 minutes and see what happens, you know.
You mean like vacuuming?
Yeah.
Doing the dishes.
Anything. Yeah. It works for anything, not just creative stuff. So now
I like that.
I also wanted to ask you, you know, tell us about this tour you were on that you just came back from.
Oh, sure. My first real band was Maudlin of the Well, and how that came about was again, in high school, I had these two friends, Toby and Byron, and we kind of bonded over like the music we liked. I was learning to play guitar when we first, you know, as freshmen, Toby wanted to learn to play guitar. So we started, you know, playing together. He switched over to bass. We were just like, they were my closest friends, hanging out. And we used to do like individual projects, so because we always recorded stuff at home, you know, on our tape decks, and so everybody kind of had their own project or whatever, and then it was like 96 after we had graduated, that summer before college, and Toby kind of said, hey, I've got this song idea, do you want to play on it? And I did, so I did some guitar solos on it. Byron wrote some lyrics and did some death metal vocals on it, and that ended up spiraling into a 4-song demo, which came up with Maudlin of the Well. And then that kind of just, it was just a lot of demoing and stuff like that during college. And then our senior year of college, we actually got signed by this small record label, and so we got an album that came out, and we did that for a couple of years, and we put out a couple other records. And then in the process of making a Maudlin of the Well record, we had a financial issue with the label, I mean, we're not talking about like a major label. We're talking about, you know, this is all small independent stuff. So there's not a lot of money going around no matter what. And so we were recording and we just weren't getting anywhere with the label. So Toby reached out to this musician, John Zorn. I don't know if you've ever heard of him. He's like an avant-garde saxophone guy in New York scene. And he liked what he heard. And so he signed us to his Zodic Records. But he was like, but the name of your band is too long. It won't fit on the album cover because it's a whole story for another thing, but all of his album covers have to follow the same design motif. And he's like, the name of your band is too long. So Toby switched the name to KO Dot. And so KO Dot came into existence in 2003. And then we released this record called Choirs of the Eye that same year. And so we came up upon the 20th anniversary of Choirs of the Eye and this year. And so Toby had, I was involved on the last KO Dot. I left the band in 2006 originally. And then Toby during the pandemic was working on some music. And again, he's like, hey, do you want to play on this? I was like, okay, cool. He's like, by the way, this is going to be the new KO Dot album. I was like, okay, I'm back in KO Dot, I guess. So he signed with a booking agent and they're like, oh yeah, we want to do like a something special for the anniversary of the record. So they just were like, oh, let's do a European set of European shows and to celebrate the record, and we'll play the record in its entirety and we'll do some other stuff. And so, yeah, it was a 2-week jaunt really. And it was just shows booked from London to the Netherlands, to Poland, to Germany, Austria, Serbia, Czech Republic, and Italy. And we were supposed to go to Scandinavia, but we couldn't get really good offers to go there. So it was like 9 shows in 10 days or something like that, one day off. And we just were celebrating the record, and it was really cool. It was cool to see people actually came out to the shows and were, you know, talked about how much the record meant to them, and you know, which is cool, you know. So yeah, that was how that tour came about.
That sounds amazing. That sounds great.
It really was. And it was so, because when I was originally in KO Dot, we did some touring of the US in like 2004, 2005. And it was like night and day, the touring experience, because at that time, you know, we had some band members didn't like each other very well. Oh. And when you're stuck in a van with somebody for 10 hours a day, you know, if you don't like that person, it can be annoying. But this was really well organized, and it was the original people who were involved with the record for the with some other people who we hired, friends and everything. And so we had a good group of people, and it was well organized. We were treated really well. I've never had green rooms in my life. And we had pretty much a green room at every single show except for one. And they had food for us and wine and, you know, drinks. And it was like, I'm like, what is this? and we would play these shows and, you know, and there was just like just a lot of really cool people and fans who came out to the different shows. And it was, you know, it makes you feel good. With everything else going on, and I always kind of think I play such a small part in the history of those bands, because I just did the guitar solos. Like, I didn't even, it wasn't my songs. I just kind of was there because it was the band that had the most momentum going for it. And so I just was like, all right, let me try this out for a while. And so I never thought I had a huge part in it, but, you know, it still was cool to meet people who are like, oh, I really love what you did. And, you know, it's good to see you back playing with the band and everything like that. So it was cool.
Yeah, that sounds great. I mean, you know, you talked earlier about, I guess, not achieving your rock and roll dreams, quote unquote.
Yeah.
But I mean, that's pretty damn close.
Yeah.
I mean, that's really freaking close.
And, it is.
You know, to be able to, you know, go all the way to Europe and do that and have fans who, you know, recognize your music and remember it from a couple decades ago is great. So yeah. So I'm really happy you got to do that.
Thank you. Yeah. It was very fun.
Appreciate you sharing all of that with us, Greg. And now is the point in the program where we're going to turn over the steering wheel to you.
Okay.
We asked you to introduce us to some underappreciated songs that feature the acoustic guitar. I kind of got that idea because of the, you know, the little guitar clips that you would share on Facebook and stuff where you are doing those alternate tunings and
yep.
With your Martin guitar, I get the sense that you're like a Martin.
I am.
Loyalist.
Yeah. I'm a huge Martin fan.
You can mm-hmm. go in whatever order you want. We have four songs to talk about. So maybe you could give us, you know, a little introduction for each song and let us know, you know, why you chose it and why that's an
sure,
important
of course.
song to you. And we'll have a nice little discussion about those.
Sure. Yeah. So yeah, it's funny. I think based on the stuff I post on social media, people might think I primarily play acoustic guitar, and I do both, but acoustic is something I really love. I just love strumming and playing and coming up with interesting ideas on the acoustic, because I don't know, it's just something I love doing. So when you asked me about that, I was like, well, I don't have the hugest knowledge of acoustic music, but I kind of decided to go with it in my own way, and how for things that I thought, you know, were interesting to me in terms of how acoustic was used or whatever. So I think the first one I sent you was the John Williams, who's a classical guitar player, not the symphony guy, not the Star Wars composer. And I chose that one because I briefly studied classical guitar in college and sucked horribly at it. And classical guitar is such a mystery to me, but it's something I love. And the John Williams thing came from when I was at a guitar workshop that I used to go to in the summers, and I took a classical class there, and the guy showed me these pieces from this John Williams concert, and this was one of them. And it's called the Usher Waltz. It's by it was composed by a Russian composer whose name eludes me at the moment, who's still alive. But and I remember I was like, oh, classical guitar can be like this. You know, it's like, I mean, this is a totally metal tune. This isn't like, it's not like, you know, Mozart here. This is like, you know, discordant, and there's loud bits and quiet bits. And I was just like, this is freaking amazing. And it blew my mind and kind of opened me up to, you know, classical guitar in a way that I hadn't really been exposed to it, even though I was trying to play it. Classical music never really jived with me too much, unfortunately, but that kind of was a gateway drug for me. So that's why I chose that one.
So Joe, this one seemed to be something that would be in your wheelhouse. And the composer, I have it in my notes here, was Nikita Koshkin, if I'm saying that.
Thank you. Yeah, Koshkin. Yeah.
Joe, did you ever come across that composer in your education? Do you know anything about him?
Not at all. Not at all. That was definitely a new one for me.
Cool.
But I thought it was awesome. Like, really cool. And then, like, obviously looking at the title, Usher Waltz, like, you have some ideas about what it's going to sound like, and it totally blows those out of the water, yeah. Right?
Yeah.
Like, it's not even close to that. But it was just, I am not a guitar player. So when I hear things like that being played by one person on one instrument, I'm always like, Where's everybody else? Because it sounds like there's three people playing at the same time.
Yeah.
So that was incredibly impressive. But I really enjoyed it. I thought it was, you know, it's definitely a dynamic piece, and I think it's really just a great way to showcase an amazing player, you know, if they can play this type of thing. What about you, Dan? What did you think?
I agree with all those sentiments, and it does throw you a little curveball because the first half of the piece kind of sounds how like you would expect it to sound. I mean, it sounds like a waltz, and even though, you know, I've gained most of my classical music knowledge, you know, having Joe as my as my brother, it's something that I think anyone, at least in the first half, would kind of be like, okay, this sounds somewhat familiar, like somewhere in the ether you get to hear a classical waltz. But then halfway through, it just like takes all of these unexpected turns, and there's like these bends and harmonics and you know, all kinds of stuff, and even kind of has like a little bit of a sense of humor at the end with the way that the last few phrases are put together. There's all these like pregnant pauses.
Yeah, I mean, I'm glad you both liked it. Yeah, it's and as far as the classical guitar technique goes, I mean, you never bend strings in classical guitar. That is just, you know, it's very hard to do on nylon strings, for whatever reason, and B, it just, they never call for it. And just to have these kind of wild vibratos and things like that, like it was stuff that is really not done in classical guitar for the most part, you know, except for with 20th century composers. And yeah, and a side note, it was funny. I found this artist a couple of years ago. I forget what her last name is because her Instagram is Marina's Decacord, and she's a Russian guitar player who plays a 10 string acoustic guitar, classical guitar. And I found out from like watching her stuff that she studied with Nikita Koshkin in Russia. And so I was like, oh, I get it now. So he just seemed to be like a kind of guy who wanted to do interesting guitar, like stuff, new stuff, like to try new stuff on the classical that, you know, challenged maybe preconceived notions. So,
fun fact, for some reason that we'll never uncover, my first guitar was a Yamaha classical guitar. I think it was like the cheapest guitar in the place. Mm-hmm. And that's why I got it, because I never learned how to play it properly. It was all messed up by the time I got rid of it, because classical guitar has no pick guard, so I was just like smashing it with my pick all the time. But anyway, what's the next one we got up?
So the next one, so I chose Song to the Siren by Tim Buckley, and specifically I specifically went with the YouTube version when he was on the Monkees. It's a clip from when he was on the Monkees TV program, and I don't know about you, Dan, but for me, Nick at Night was a big thing when I was when I was a kid. When, you know, like what 8 year or 10 year old kid is watching the Donna Reed show? That I am, and and you know, Donna Reed and Mr. Ed, and then the Monkees, and I was a huge fan of the Monkees, and I for the life of me don't remember this episode, so I don't remember why Tim Buckley was featured on this one episode, but and I don't remember the episode. I'm assuming I probably saw it at some point as a kid, but anyway, you know, Tim Buckley is the father of Jeff Buckley, you know, who, and, you know, lots of people love. I mean, I love Jeff Buckley. And yeah, when I heard this song, I actually heard a cover of it first, by John Frusciante from the Red Hot Chili Peppers from one of his solo records. And I was like, this is such a beautiful sentiment song, you know, and it's, you know, and but when I heard the Tim Buckley version, I heard the YouTube version first. And I was like, this is such a beautifully simple, you know, 12 string. I think he's playing on a 12 string and it's just, you know, chords accompanying a very vocal, simple vocal melody. And it's really beautiful. I then got the album that it's on, like the recorded version, and it's like totally different. I don't know if you experienced that, but the actual recorded version on, I forget the name of the record, but it's like a total like psychedelic, like weird, like a weird arrangement. And I was just like, this isn't the same song that I, but it's, there's just something beautiful about the simplicity of the acoustic performance. So I love that song. And I think it's a just really beautiful.
No, I agree. It was perfect. And I have to say you're sounding very nostalgia with this choice. I don't know you very well, Greg, but thinking about Dan, his experience in St. Francis, was like, are we just going to go down like a like late 60s, early 70s rabbit hole? Because this is definitely part of it, as like a nice little curveball to that. But he plays it beautifully. He sings it beautifully. And I think it's just like an awesome homage to that era of so many great guitar players.
Yeah.
And then when you like strip it all down, you're like, oh my God, you're just like this wonderful musician. But like, it's hard to see that through all the other stuff that was popular at that time. So definitely appreciate that choice and appreciate the version that you shared with us. Dan, what about you? Did you know about Tim Buckley before this? Probably more so than I did, but
well, yeah, I mean, I know about Tim Buckley because, like Greg, I love Jeff Buckley, and
yeah,
you know, we did kind of like a mini Jeff Buckley episode a while back,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Maybe people can check out. But for some reason, I had always been meaning to check out Tim Buckley's music, and I never have. It's just a great performance. And even though there are some like limitations to the sound, you can tell just how like lush the whole thing sounds, even with just him in the guitar, because got all the overtones from the 12 string, and he's got a very nice like resonance to his voice.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't mean he's being loud. That means that he's got a nice, you know, rounded out sound to his voice, and the combination of that with the guitar, I think, was the most appealing part of that song. And it reminds me a little bit of, I'm getting like some like Led Zeppelin 3 vibes, mm-hmm, from this performance and stuff. So yeah, so it was definitely a cool piece.
Yeah, I think you mentioned too, Joe, that yeah, it's the stripped downness of it is really, it's something appealing to me, because one thing that I love to do on acoustic guitars is I love studying song structures and chord progressions. Like I geek out about that for whatever reason. And I love hearing like acoustic versions of arrangements. I love hearing, you know, different things and like that. And I love just hearing the way the resonances of the chords hit. I'm always amazed when someone can do a stripped down performance that's captivating, because it's something that I have a hard time doing. You know, I've tried a couple open mics and I've tried to sing and play guitar at the same time, and it doesn't go that well. but that song just stripped down. It's, you know, and it's just a beautiful love song, you know. The next one I chose I did Man in a Shed by Nick Drake. And I wasn't sure with Nick Drake because I feel like he had kind of a renaissance, because I think his music was featured in, I think, some Wes Anderson movie, one of those arty films from the 2000s or whatever. But Nick Drake, I kind of learned about because, again, he was someone who was a singer-songwriter who did really interesting guitar tunings. And so it was kind of like, oh yeah, you should check out Nick Drake if that's what you're into. And it was hard to choose exactly which one I should do. Because I think there's a lot of different Nick Drake songs, but I thought Man in a Shed would be kind of a fun one because I think sometimes it's, if you want to talk about lyrics, and my favorite thing of this song is that it's got this kind of narrative where he's starting off singing this almost kind of fairy tale or tale or whatever about, you know, fictional people. And then in the end, he comes out and says, oh, by the way, that's you and that's me, you know, like this is actually, you know, and so it's like, if you're like whatever girl he was writing the song about, it's just like, oh, you think I'm just saying this really interesting song? No, I'm actually talking about you and why you should date me. And I'm probably butchering that and making it sound a lot more primitive than what it, you know, but I just thought the way he twists the words and the mixed with the music, I don't know. I've always loved that one. So, you know,
Joe, did you, Dan,
do you want to go? Oh,
well, I was just going to ask you if you knew much about Nick Drake, because when Greg sent us the list of songs, I was like, I have a feeling Joe is really gonna like this, and I don't know why I never like told you to listen to Nick Drake.
So my knowledge of Nick Drake is about the same as like Drake cakes, like
Drake's cakes.
I know they exist, but I don't know what anything about it. But no, you're absolutely right. I love this one. What was awesome for me was like the way, because I never think about it this way, but like the way the guitar, the piano, and the bass all fit together. And it's still being played as like the main melody lead accompaniment, but it gave me a totally different perspective because of the other instruments within the ensemble on this piece. Because at first I was like, oh, what else is playing there? Because it's something, it's not all guitar. But it took me a minute to figure it out. And, you know, I think also harmonically, it kind of keeps you on your toes, which was fun. And I guess that goes to sort of the sentiment of the narrative, of the songwriting that Greg just mentioned. But what about you? You sound like you're a Nick Drake fan. Have you been a fan of his for a while and just keeping it in your back pocket, not sharing good musicians with me? Is that where we're at now?
Yeah, I guess. But yeah, like this whole album, his first album, which is called Five Leaves Left, is kind of a classic at this point. And you know, Greg's right. He unfortunately was someone who had an untimely death and produced this great music, and it was kind of lost in the shuffle for a while. And it wouldn't surprise me if it was in a Wes Anderson movie. I know there was a Nick Drake song in the movie Garden State. And I think the first time I heard him, it was on a Volkswagen ad. It was the song Pink Moon.
Yeah.
But yeah, this whole album is great. And it was really interesting the way, not only the arrangement, but the way that it's mixed. And I'm not sure if this was like a remastering thing or if it was something that they did with the original. But if you listen to it with, ear pods or headphones or whatever, it starts off with this kind of improvised sounding guitar on its own, and it's panned all the way to your right headphone. And I was like, is my left ear pod dead? What's going on? And then the the bass and the piano come in, and they're all the way to the left, and somehow that works. And it just makes all the notes and the interplay between all the instruments, really clear and just sound that much better. Nick Drake is of that like late 60s, early 70s singer songwriter type that you would think of, but he's really his own thing. He's got kind of a quirky voice, and he's got his own way of playing. It's just very distinctive.
Yeah, it is. And the arrangements, that's another thing is, I love simple songs too. I'm a big Johnny Cash fan, and you think all of his songs are like three chords, and I think a lot of people assume when people are playing like these acoustic guitar songs that they're doing just like simplistic chords, and the guitar is really just acting as a basic sort of accompaniment for the voice and the lyrics. And I think he kind of bridged this thing where he was marrying really cool lyrics and really great vocal performance with very intricate guitar playing and stuff that not a lot of other singer-songwriter types would probably be doing. And, I think if he didn't sing on them, you probably would enjoy some of those songs just with instrumentally too, but the addition of the voice and the lyrics, I loved the vibe on Nick Drake. And Five Leaves is I love that record a lot. So yeah, if you haven't shared it with Joe,
that's like a feature.
Come on,
yes.
Don't hold back, man.
Well, it's not like I gotta burn him a CD.
I know.
Can go look for it. He can go look for it now.
Yeah, I know, exactly. Yeah, send him the Spotify link. And then the last one I sent was The Bed by Lou Reed. And I think my main reason for choosing it was, I think, and I'm just looking at my thing to make sure that is the name of the song, because some of his songs blend together and I forget the names. I think Lou Reed is mostly known for kind of, the rock stuff, obviously the Velvet Underground and that kind of thing, and Walk on the Wild Side and this other stuff. But a friend of mine really turned me on to the Berlin album, which is a concept record. And I'm a sucker for a concept album. It's the prog rock guy in me. I love concept albums. And I was like, I'm curious to see what a Lou Reed concept album would sound like. And it's such a great record. It's something that a friend of mine, Nick, and I have bonded over. I think we became better friends because, just discussing Lou Reed and it's this very special like musical bonding moment between us. And The Bed, I thought, was just really cool because, yeah, it's a very simplistic performance, and it just conveys so much emotion in the performance. And just kind of like Nick Drake, obviously Lou Reed's got a very distinctive, quirky voice, which not a lot of people, not everyone is into, I admit, but for whatever reason, the weaknesses in his voice, I think, are what make the vocal performance that much better. And I don't know why that is sometimes, but why there are some vocalists who can sing just a little off key and it works perfectly. And just the way he says, he kind of does the, "Oh, what a feeling" part of the song. Just the way it's not like a powerful vocal performance, but it speaks volumes. And so it's one of my favorite tracks on that record. And I thought it would be a cool you know, acoustic track.
Dan, I would love to hear your impressions of this one.
Okay, sure. Well, first of all, this selection was the biggest surprise for me because I don't know everything there is to know about Lou Reed, but I'm very familiar with the Transformer album and some Velvet Underground stuff. I don't think I've ever heard this before. And when I think of Lou Reed, I think of like fearlessly weird and gritty lyrics, which this has. But I don't really think of guitar playing. But, you know, much like his voice, which is, you know, kind of wrong, but in all the right ways, it's kind of like this guitar playing is very simple, but everything is exactly right for what he's trying to do here. And instead of being like a conventional acoustic guitar song where like people think of like the finger picking or pleasing melodies or any other kind of like pleasant aesthetics, this is more like atmospheric and like sets this dark mood for this tragic scene that's being described. And it's really effective. And I kept wanting to listen to it again because it is so beautiful, but I really don't want to hear the story about like the suicide again.
Yeah.
But it's like, and then there's just like wild, like choral stuff that's going on at the end. And I'm like, is this when was he married to Laurie Anderson at this time? But he wasn't.
I don't know. Yeah.
I checked because for people who don't know, Laurie Anderson is, I guess you could call her a performance artist. She plays violin. She's a musician as well. And she was married to Lou Reed, from, I guess, 2008 until he died. But like hearing that song, I was like, did Laurie Anderson have an influence on this? But apparently not, because that was way before. This came out in the early 70s, and that was way before he was married to her. Mm-hmm. But anyway. But it's a really well done song, but it's just like so gut-wrenching.
Yeah.
And like, we don't often issue a content warning on this program, but if you have any aversions to like talk about blood or suicide or anything like that, then steer clear of this. But it's a really well done song.
It is. It is very intense. The whole record is intense, by the way. What about you, Joe? What did you think of it?
So it's interesting because I really thought it was like, oh, this is just an excuse to talk about Lou Reed, which we have not done on the show. And that's perfectly fine because let's just have a reason to talk about him because he was pretty important. But to echo Dan's point, it did take me like two or three times listening to this to like figure out the guitar, what was going on there. Because I was like, I couldn't get past the lyrics and and the story, right? Because like that's like first and foremost in your mind. You're like, wait a minute, did that? Wait, what? Really? Oh, we're going there, I guess. but I appreciated that it was subtle and it definitely had a different style than what I think a lot of people think about when they hear Lou Reed. I think you're exactly right, Dan. It does the perfect task of painting the mood in collaboration with the lyrics. So, you know, quite effective. Again, probably not going on a playlist for me anytime soon for all the reasons we've mentioned, but kind of a cool thing to listen to a little more closely, because I don't think I would have found this one of Lou Reed on my own for sure.
And it's funny you guys say that, because I think I went through a period where I listened to this record every day. So I subjected myself to that, you know, for a little while at least. And it's a tough, you know, I don't know. I like dark, dark songs too. I like happy songs as well. You know, it probably was around the same time that I started listening to Nick Cave's Murder Ballads too, which is another super super lyrically depressing record. But yeah, there's just something about this record, and there's more to the album than just obviously the song, and there's all sorts of different. I think it was a flop. I don't think it was a successful record from what I remember. Still, I think it was, yeah, people didn't want, you know, they were like, hey, where's, you know, Transformer, where's, you know, Perfect Day, or one of those, you know, Lou Reed songs, and this album is like, oh no, let me talk about being in love with a drug addict and committing suicide and all the other dark stuff that's on that record. So I love that record a lot. So, but I can understand not wanting to listen to it every day.
Yeah, I mean, I listen to plenty of you know, dark and depressing music too, but there's just something about like the starkness and the plainness of the way that he's saying what he's saying, and the fact that you can understand every word.
Yeah,
and I think that's what does it more than anything else.
Yeah, I never thought about it like that, but yeah, there is something about that it's like, yeah, that you're, it's really, he's like, it's really easy to understand me, so let me enunciate all these horrible words that are gonna haunt your dreams. And I think there's even a part, it's not in this, I was hoping it wasn't this song, there is one song on that record which I have a hard time listening to, because again, I think it's about, I forget the full story now in my head, but I think there's a part where they talk about like the kid they had together, and like, and the song ends with like basically like samples of a kids yelling mommy, mommy, and it's just like, you know, and so like, yeah, like it's supposed to give it, yeah, these are neglected children, and it's just like, and it's horrible. It's horrible. I can't, it's so hard to listen to, like I'm not a father myself, but like, just, you know, but like the idea of a child being neglected is something that really wrenches at, if you're a decent human being, it should wrench at your heart. And Lou Reed's like, yeah, let me put that right there in front of your face. Listener. But yeah.
Well, on that note, bye everyone. No. I mean, that was our last selection, but before we go, I want to say thanks again. And I do, Greg, want to give you the opportunity to, you know, share any social media handles you want to share, you know, let people know how to, you know, keep up with what you're doing, and, you know, and we'll not only post links to all this music for anyone that wants to check it out, you know, we'll post it in the show notes, but we'll post links to your social media as well, if you would like.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, you can find me, probably I'd say follow me on Instagram, more than Facebook, 'cause I really don't want to like using Facebook, but, as much, but, my Instagram handle is RetconGreg. And yeah, like I release all my own music, on my own record label, big quotation marks there, 'cause it doesn't feel like a label, but, it's called Retcon Industries. And so all the music is of at least my stuff. My bands are all over the place, but my music's on retconindustries.bandcamp.com. And I'll share you, I have a link tree, which I think is the easier way to share with people, 'cause it's got links to everything. And I find it, 'cause it's hard to remember all the URLs.
For sure.
Yeah. So yeah, I'd say that Recon Greg on Instagram, you know, I post a lot of, I want to post more guitar stuff. That's kind of, kind of what I'd love is to start doing that more.
Cool. Well, that's our show. Thank you so much for joining us, Greg. It's been really fun.
Yeah, thank you.
And also, don't forget to follow us on Instagram if you're not doing that already, at Brothers in Song, for all the latest news on the show. Thanks again for listening, and take care until next time, everybody. Brothers in Song is written and produced by Joseph Collin and Daniel Collin, and edited by Daniel Collin. To keep up with the latest news, follow us on Instagram at Brothers in Song. Until next time, listen to some new music. You just may surprise yourself.